Now, the one that was yet to come was when the Roman Empire as an empire fell, and it was replaced by the last form of Roman power, which was the Gothic, or in other words, when those ten powers came down. So you see, verse 9 then, and verse 10 is explaining it. And when he cometh, he's going to continue a short space. So there were the seven forms of Roman government. So the seven heads then, we are told, are seven mountains. For the sake of some of the younger ones here who may not be familiar with all these symbols we just glibly pluck out of the air, why do we know that mountains represent government? Well, one, we're told there that they represent kings, but you know, it's not an uncommon symbol. Have a look just quickly, say, at the book of Obadiah. If you'd like one or two other proofs of how this symbol of mountains is used for government, Obadiah, we don't have to say chapter anything, it's the whole of the book of Obadiah is a contest between two mountains, the Mount of Esau and the Mount of Zion. But take the last verses from 17 to 21. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possession. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh hath spoken it. And come down to verse 21, and saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be Yahweh. So there you've got the mountain of Esau opposed to the mountain of Yahweh. And Esau, or the Edomites, stand as the latter-day haters of Israel. So you've got a contest between two mountains. And one other passage, which we know very well, is in Micah chapter 4, the opening two verses, which perhaps sometimes we take rather literally, but, you know, although it's literally true, it's not meant to be taken exactly that way, as a close reading of the verse will show. Micah chapter 4, verse 1, but in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of Yahweh shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. See all the symbology there? Doesn't mean to say Mount Zion's got to be higher than Mount Everest. It's simply saying that the mountain, in other words, the government, the power of the house of Yahweh, will be established in the top of the mountain. It's going to be the highest, because it'll be over all other powers. It shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. Why flow unto it? Because peoples are represented by waters and rivers, you know, as we've got in Revelation 17. So there you've got it, that the mountain represents talent. And of course, the very well-known one in Daniel chapter 2, when the stone smites the image of Nebuchadnezzar on the face, it becomes a great mountain and fills the whole earth. So mountains, therefore, represent forms of government. Right, so what have we got? We've got the Roman beast then as having seven stages of government, so that in the time when John was writing, he was living in the sixth, which was Imperial Rome, the Rome of the emperors. That was to be replaced by a new Rome, which was going to be when the ten tribes came down out of Europe and overthrew it, and that one would continue for a short space. Now, is that all right up till now? Any questions on that before we move on to the next one? Oh, I think it's time to change your taste anyway, so I guess we can do that now. Right, let's go back then and you see why I had to jump ahead to certain verses to explain earlier verses. So coming back then to verses 7 and 8. The beast which thou sawest was and is not, but is hereafter to ascend out of the abyss and to go away into perdition. There's a lot said in that. The beast that thou sawest was, that means it existed in the past. It doesn't exist at the moment, but hereafter it's going to ascend out of the abyss. The word abyss used here is just representative of the nations as a whole. as the abyss is synonymous with the sea. It has the same idea, and just like Daniel saw a certain beast come up out of the sea, it simply says that this beast is going to come up out of the nations, and eventually it is going to go away into perdition. Now he says, those who dwell upon the earth, of whom there hath not been written the names upon the book of life from the foundation of the world, shall wonder when they behold the beast that was, but is not, although it is. Now, from what we've said, can you work that out? Here's John looking at a beast which was, but it isn't, but it is. Now bear in mind that John is seeing this beast in its latter day manifestation. He sees this beast over here, the beast of Revelation chapter 17, when in fact he is still living contemporary with this pagan one down here. But in vision, he's seeing this one. So this beast up here was, it means it existed prior to that, because in fact it is simply the development of all of these stages. It is not, because it hasn't yet existed, and yet it is. Well, it is, because it's just as much Roman as that one was. In fact, I should say, it is just as much Babylonian as that one. It's a Babylonian thing. It's manifesting itself in its Roman faith. So the beast was, that is, it was there. It is not, because it's over there. And it is, because in principle it's the same thing. Alright? John's here. He looks at that beast there. And he says that beast was, because it's occurred before in a different form. It is not, because it hasn't yet happened. And yet it is, because in principle it exists now. So each one of those has a different inflection of them. You don't sort of understand them all in absolute terms. So the beast existed in the past as a pagan beast, as a beast of the sea, as a beast of the earth, but not as the beast of Revelation 17. And so in that sense you could say, well, it doesn't really exist, does it? So he says, no, it is not. And yet you say, really, it's the same thing in principle as what's there now. And he says, yes, it is. Is that all that hard, or I don't know that I can say anything more about it than that, except that John is here looking forward 2,000 years, and in looking forward 2,000 years of that beast, he can say that beast was, in other words, that beast has existed in the past. Now, in what sense did that beast exist in the past? Well, you see, as far as Daniel was concerned, he only saw one beast, and he just slightly modified that beast. As far as John is concerned, he saw that beast of Revelation 17 as being motivated by the same principles that motivated the great red dragon, the beast of the sea, and the beast of the earth. So in that sense, you can say that beast has existed before. But strictly speaking, in its pure form, it hasn't yet existed. So we can say there's another sense in which he's going to say, well, no, it isn't yet, not in its exact form. And yet, in principle, it's existing even now when he's writing. Yet it is, because what I can see about me, you know, the mystery of iniquity is already working, Paul says. So that beast is there, although it's not manifested in that exact form. So what we're saying is that in one breath, John is talking about the exact form of it, in another breath, he's talking about the principle of it. So the beast was, is not, and yet is. Let's just note the way it's set out here in the notes, which really are essentially in this section slabs taken from Brother Thomas, where he points out that the beast which is described in these verses is the same one that has been introduced in chapter 13, right? That's the beast of the earth and the beast of the sea, but with certain additional particulars. In the days of John, it didn't exist, for the 10 horns upon it had not yet then received the kingdom. So John could say then that that beast does not yet exist because the ten horns haven't been properly formed. Alright? Even this dragon down here in the days of John hadn't yet seen those ten horns. So John could say, well, no, that beast doesn't yet exist because the ten horns had not then received the kingdom. The territory upon which they now exist was then included in the western division of the Roman Empire. But upon it, distinct horn kingdoms did not exist. In this sense, therefore, it is the beast that is not. Right, so there's our first point. Now the next point is, how can it be the beast that was? So the second paragraph is the beast that was. Further clues are given to the interpretation of this symbol in verse 10. There are seven kings, five are fallen, one is and the other is not yet come. Now we've dealt with this. The beast of the sea in its origin could reckon up only seven heads upon the seven mountains. But this beast of the abyss can count the same seven with an additional head, which is styled the eighth. Now I haven't commented on that yet, so just let's keep reading as though it didn't exist. The eighth head is the Holy Roman Empire, answering to the two-horned beast of Revelation 13 with its spiritual emperor in Rome and its secular emperor in Vienna. In verse 11 we are informed that the eighth head is one of the seven. It was in fact a revived form of the sixth or imperial head, and although it was a different line of emperors, it was nevertheless a government based upon the same principles as the old pagan imperial Roman system. In this sense, it can be styled the beast that was. And then thirdly, whilst this Romano-Babylonian system has changed its form over the years, at no stage could it ever be said that it did not exist in some form or other. And therefore John, whilst saying that the beast was and is not, is also correct in stating yet it is. Well, there's this eighth head now which we've been introduced to. We come then to verse 9. The mind having wisdom is this. The seven heads are seven mountains. Where the woman is sitting upon them, they are also seven governments. Five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. But when it may have come, it is necessary that it continue a short time. And the beast that was, but is not, even he is the eighth. Now, this is where our symbology starts to get a little tricky, because whilst up to now we've got a beast, we say that's okay, he's got seven heads, yep, that's okay, seven forms of government, five have gone, the one that now is the sixth, and the seventh one gets to come, right. Ten horns, yeah, that's when the ten tribes of Europe come down and invade it, and the kingdom becomes Gothic, that's all right. Now when that seventh head falls, there's going to be an eighth head, and the eighth head is the beast that was and is not. So that that beast is the eighth head of the beast. Hard to get a picture of that one, isn't it? Well, that's what it says, doesn't it? And the beast that was but is not, even he is the eighth, and he is of the seven. So you see what John's doing. He's saying that this beast that we're looking at here is in fact the eighth head of one of these earlier states of the beast. They only had seven heads. How can you have an eighth head? Well, he said the eighth head isn't really an eighth head. It's one of the other seven. It's in fact head number six, reinstated. And head number six was Imperial Rome. So he's telling us in simple language this, that after the time that the ten tribes out of Europe come down and overthrow Rome and establish the seventh and the last head, there would be a later stage when they would fall, and when once again there would be emperors. So that whilst this is now an eighth stage, you couldn't really say it's something new, because it's a re-establishment of what was the sixth one, because the sixth head was Imperial Rome, and at the time of Charlemagne, when the Pope crowned him Emperor of Rome, he reinstated the sixth head, But as far as John is concerned, it's not really the sixth head, is it? Not truly. It's the eighth. And yet it's not really a new one, because it's really the sixth one reinstated. It's a bit like the was and is not. It's a new one, and yet it's an old one that's come back in a new form. So the beast really only had seven heads, and even though it had an eighth one, the eighth one was really the sixth one re-established. That's not all that hard, really, is it? I don't think. The seven mountains, we've understood. The seven kings, we were told, were the seven forms of government: regal, consular, dictatorial, decemviral, tribunicial forms of government, which is past. The one that is was the imperial, and the one that is not yet come, but would continue for a short space, was the Gothic kingdom. Now, the Gothic kingdom was at length replaced by a papal system, ruled jointly from Rome and Vienna. And whilst it was a new system, it was, in another sense, the re-establishment of Imperial Rome under the name of the Holy Roman Empire. And it is this phase of the Imperial Rome, that was going to go into position. This eighth or papal form of Rome would exist at the time when the Lord will return. Now, you might say, ah, yes, but you said the Holy Roman Empire was overthrown. Yes, the Holy Roman Empire was sort of overthrown by Napoleon. As an empire, it ceased to exist. But the principle is still there in Europe, ready to be established when, at the return of Christ and those events leading up to it, there will be yet a coalition between the powers of Europe, which in the symbology of Revelation 17 would be what? The powers of Europe. The political powers of Europe in the symbology of Revelation 17 would be what? Ten horns, right? And the papal system, which in the symbology of Revelation 17 would be what? The beast. The beast is that eighth form. So if we find now that there's going to be a coalition between the horns and the beast, this is telling us that there's going to be a Catholic Communist Confederacy. The verse 12 tells us that the ten horns which thou sawest are ten governments, European governments, which have not yet received kingdom, but they receive authority as kings 1 hour with the beast. And there it is. People often wonder how we can prove that communism and Catholicism will combine. Well, I guess it's not the easiest thing to stand up in a public lecture and say, well, there it is in Revelation 17, verse 12, as clear as a bell. You know, it takes about 3 years of a Revelation class to build up to this, and then we, you know, have to look very carefully at it. Of course, the same thing is told us in Nebuchadnezzar's image, where he's told that the feet and toes are part of iron, which is Rome, and clay, which is communism. It's the same thing. But of course, here it is. The ten horns are yet to receive power 1 hour with the beast. With the beast. So that these verses, verses 12 to 14, describe then this coalition which is going to exist between the ten horns, which consists of the European political powers, which will be dominated by Gog, of the land of Magog, with Gomer and all of those other powers with him. So there's your ten horns, and the Roman beast itself. Subsequent verses show that the time would come when they would also persecute the Roman system. So bear in mind that this beast doesn't just appear at the time of the end. This beast, of course, is essentially the Holy Roman Empire. And if you were a little worried a while ago about me saying that Napoleon overthrew the Holy Roman Empire, and yet it comes back, that is also accounted for here in these verses. When it says here, later on, verse 16, that the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, they shall hate the whore and shall make her desolate. Now that was achieved at the time of Napoleon. The ten horns of Europe robbed the Catholic power of much of its power. But the time will yet come when those horns and that beast will reunite to allow, to use another symbol, Daniel's image to stand upon its feet. So it's telling us then the ten horns representing Europe will yet once again make a coalition with these beasts. So that as history testifies in the events of the French Revolution, the period of Napoleon and such like, there was a period when they would persecute the Roman system. At the time of the end, when the Lord destroys this system, however, the papal power will have again revived and will hold sway over the nations of Europe. Now, in regard to this statement, which we read here, receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast, there are in fact two interpretations of this. There are in fact two interpretations, and I'm simply going to put them forward as two interpretations. They are not conflicting ones, they are not opposite interpretations, but there are two ways in which the phrase 1 hour can be understood, and I'll present both of these views as they are both presented in fact in the notes. We make a comment, of course, first from Brother Robert. In regard to this statement, Brother Robert states that the ten-horned, scarlet-coloured beast of Revelation 17, which we are considering, while embracing the history of that time, represents more particularly the constitution of the Roman Empire at the crisis of its destruction. Consequently, the ten kings of verse 12 are the powers that will confederate with Rome in the hour of her retribution. The cause of the unity of mind with which they give their power and strength unto the beast for 1 hour is evidently the Lord's presence in the earth, though they know not that he is the Lord, but imagine him an antichrist. These, it is added, shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. The Lamb overcomes them, but not in a moment. To make war with the Lamb is not the work of a day. It implies all that is involved in preparation, organisation, discussing plans of campaign, etc., and extends over a considerable period. This period is described as 1 hour. Now, Brother Robert states, excuse me, 1 hour is not literal, of course. It must either be taken generally, in the sense of, this is your hour and the power of darkness. In other words, the word hour can mean, in the scripture, a moment of time. It doesn't have to be a specific period of 60 minutes. And it is so used, the word hora is used of a period of time, so that the Lord would say to those who are coming to take him captive, this is your hour and the power of darkness. Doesn't mean your 60 minutes. It means this is your period of time. So it can be taken either generally, in which case the verse is saying that they will give their power as kings for a short period of time to the beast, preparatory to being overthrown. In which case we would understand that just like Nebuchadnezzar, that it will only momentarily stand on its feet as the iron and the clay are united together, which they have not yet seen, and then they will in the next instant be overthrown. So you can either take the word 1 hour in that sense, or alternatively it can be understood with precision as the fraction of a duplicated day of years. And we've come across this before, haven't we, where we have to work out how many years half an hour is or an hour is and so forth. So if we work it out, an hour of a day, year of years, would be the 12th part of 360 years, because there are 360 days in a Jewish year, and that would be 30 years. And so there is a suggestion, therefore, that it could refer to a period of 30 years. If it does refer to a period of 30 years, it would of necessity be 30 out of that 40-year period of the wilderness, of the subjugation of Israel in the wilderness of the people. And so if we were to start looking at chronology and what is generally accepted, we would say there is the 50-year period between the return of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom and the opening of the millennium. We've got 50 years. 40 years of that, or your 1600 furlongs of Revelation 14, 40 years of that is Israel's subjection in the wilderness of the people, which leaves 10 years on the front of it for the resurrection, for the judgment, and for Armageddon. But of that 40-year period, it could be that this chapter is telling us that 30 years of that will be designated to the period during which the beast shall have the horn shall have power with the beast. That is one suggestion which is made. Alternatively, it could be just stating that it is a period, and I feel that the evidence that I have yet been able to accumulate, and by all means later on someone else may like to come up with evidence that I'm unaware of, the evidence that I've been able to accumulate at the moment is I leave it as an open statement. Both of those are suitable explanations. You know, the second one, I don't know of any other great evidence to support that particular theory, but certainly it could be interpreted legitimately as 30 years. And Brother Robert does just this. He puts those two ideas forward and he just leaves it at that. The fact is, though, it is speaking of a period of time which will be a comparatively short period of time during which this coalition will exist. So that the power that the horns receive with the beast coexists with the eighth head of the beast. In the first instance, this was the Holy Roman Empire, but as there is to be a latter day manifestation of the beast, so the system must be revived in the latter day. Current trends in Europe are clear indications of this latter day development. Well, that then brings us down to the last verses of Revelation chapter 17, which in fact consists of verses that we've basically referred to before because they are explanatory verses. So that verse 15, for example, is one of those key verses which we've used to explain to us what the to explain what these symbols of waters represent. They represent peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. When we come to verses 16 and 17, we've got the conflict between the woman and the horns of the beast, which consisted of those anti-papal policies about the time of the French Revolution, which we referred to a little earlier. The Catholic Church has lost nearly all of her power and is symbolically described here as being made desolate and naked. Europe today consists of the beast with 10 horns, but in the future will once again make an alliance with the woman. And so verse 18 tells us that the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And that, of course, is another one of those excellent descriptions which leaves us in no doubt as to what it's all about. So verse 18, as we're told in the concluding section of this chapter in our notes, represents that city. Brother Thomas states, this 17th chapter contemplates so much of the judgment of the great harlot as pertains to her pre-adventual consumption. It's essentially speaking about what will happen prior to her destruction, or prior, rather, to the coming of the Lord. Chapter 18 speaks about her subsequent discussion. In other words, the 17th discussion, destruction. In other words, the 17th chapter describes the activities of the papal system up to the coming of Christ, and subsequent chapters describe her destruction at the hand of the Lord and the saints. So God willing, at our next class, we'll go over to Revelation chapter 18, which also I think we'll we probably will cover most of that in one night. Well, I think we've got a few minutes, so if anybody's got any comments they would like to make or any questions, I think with the chairman's permission we can take those. The question is, I made the comment that the eighth beast was actually the eighth head was actually the reinstatement of the sixth. It doesn't say in the Bible that it was. No, it doesn't. It just tells us that it was one of the seven. It doesn't say it was a seventh, it says it was of the seven. So we've got to then work out which one of the seven it was. Well, they never re-established kings and that. It was the emperors which were re-established. So we know from history that it was the sixth one that was reinstated. Although nowhere in Revelation 17, you're quite correct, nowhere in Revelation 17 does it say that it was the sixth. But on the other hand, you didn't quite read that note accurately enough, because there is an of in the front of it. It doesn't say the eighth beast was the seventh, but it was of the seventh. So it was one of the seven. So we've got to then work out which one of the seven it was. Well, they never re-established kings and that. It was the emperors which were re-established. So we know from history that it was the sixth one that was reinstated. Although nowhere in Revelation 17, you're quite correct, nowhere in Revelation 17 does it say that it was the sixth. But on the other hand, you didn't quite read that note accurately enough, because there is an of in the front of it. It doesn't say the eighth beast was the seventh, but it was of the seventh. So it was one of the seven. Oh, well, any one of the seven. It could either be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7. So it happens to be number 6. I was glad you raised that point, really, because that's right. I sort of took for granted that everyone was satisfied it was the 6, but in fact the Bible doesn't say it was the 6, but in fact there is no doubt that it was the 6, because history is, well, abundantly clear that it was the Holy Roman Empire, and the word empire and imperial are the same word. Do we assume that everybody knows that imperial means an empire? If you didn't, well, it does. That's it. When we talk about imperial Rome, we're talking about the Rome of the emperors. And so Charlemagne was an emperor, and therefore it was imperial Rome, which was the 6th head, but it wasn't, it was the 8th, which was not the 7th, and it was number 6. Take you to task, because we have an ecclesial policy that we weren't going to announce those lectures, which you've just announced. But seeing as how you didn't name them, well, it doesn't matter. Well, unfortunately, there are some other theories. Brother Pierce's book, what's that last one, Joe? That blue one. Unfortunately, some of the other theories you find on pages 68 to 69. Not that we're proud of the fact that some parts of the ecclesial world appear to be unsure of their views, but he does list 3 theories down there, and if you like to read them in the light of what we've been studying, well, you might find it illuminating. I just feel very sorry about this situation. I mean, we've got to be critical about it, there's no two ways about it. But I feel very sorry that this situation has existed, and it's come about because people have, for some reason or other, thought that they could do without the pioneer writings, and it is quite natural that when you get away from that faith, and that you sit down with a book like Revelation, and if you've got a bit of an imaginative mind, you can soon develop another theory, and you can build a whole structure on it, and you'll find that the 3 theories which are in here listed as being based upon Revelation 17 are quite fantastic, really. I'm not going to read them because I don't intend to propagate that theory, but if you are interested in some other people's theories, that's the case. And yes, your point then is quite correct, that if you study these other theories carefully, there is a flaw that you'll find, and this is one of the keys to the flaw, that it doesn't anywhere say that the whore was going to be destroyed. She was only going to be made desolate and naked, and they shall eat her flesh, burn her with fire, would be the ultimate, it goes on then to speak about the ultimate destruction in chapter 18. But the fact is that as far as Napoleon was concerned, he destroyed it as a system at that stage, but the underlying principle was still there, and it would revive again in the time of the end, when the horns would once again become one with the beast. Her destruction, of course, is when the whole thing is given to the burning fire, chapter 18 and Daniel chapter 7. Oh, that's an interesting point there, Maynard. How was it that Brother Thomas in 1848 was able to see this so clearly? Generally, when we talk on this, and I for one would be a great proponent of this theory, but I say 1848 would have been one of the most difficult years in the world's history to prophesy certain things. And yet at the same time, in another sense, it was one of the best years in history to be able to see things. See, Brother Thomas was living at a time when, no doubt, he was, I believe, providentially raised up to do this work. But he was living at a time in 1848 when he could see what had happened as a result of the French Revolution and the work of Napoleon. But he didn't have all of these other things cluttering his mind, like Arab-Israeli conflict, Germany rising to a power in Europe under Hitler. And you see, these false theories have developed in sort of the second half of the 20th century, when there's been so many other events happening which to the eye of the flesh seem to be so important that they can't see the wood for the tree. Now, Brother Thomas was really, in 1848, able to get a very clear picture. He could see from the scriptures that Israel had to come back to the land, and he could see that Russia had to rise up. But he didn't have all of these other dozen and one events cluttering his mind. It was the papal system which was the real thing that was worrying the world, and had been for many years. So, you know, when you say that, how was that Brother Thomas able to see it? In a sense, 1848 would have been one of the clearest years to see the true nature of the Catholic system. But on the other hand, if in a few weeks' time I stand up and I give a lecture and say, you know, in the year 1848, Brother, this man was able to foresee the regathering of Israel and the rise of Russia, that is also true, that there was absolutely no evidence of that in the world. So he relied on the scripture. Where these people go wrong is that they're looking at the world and saying, now, Arabs, I reckon the Arabs have got to play a part. So they make the Arabs fit it. And one of these theories makes the Arabs the ten horns. What do they make the Arabs? Anyway, one of the theories fits the Arabs in the Revelation chapter 17. Because, you see, you're looking at the world and it seems to be the Arabs. So all we're saying is that in the providence of God, he has arranged the time for his purpose, and in raising up men like Brother Thomas, they were provided with a mind, the sort of mind which was able to ascertain these things, and he was the right man in the right place at the right time. And as we often say, Brother Robert followed on and he performed a work which maybe Brother Thomas couldn't have done, but then at the same time Brother Robert probably couldn't have done the work that Brother Thomas did. So when you go back to 1848, you are reading the spirit of the truth 130 years ago, but you're also reading what the spirit of the age was like. And you can see the Catholic system for what it was. The world today doesn't see the Catholic system for what it is, and it sees Arabs and Israelis and Germans and... another one of the theories is that the woman is apostate Israel, don't they? And that the Jerusalem is the city which is going to be destroyed. So you can see they've allowed current events to blind their mind to the true fundamental base of the whole hope of Revelation.
Further questions, brethren and sisters? We'll now call upon Brother Norm to come forward with the announcement. We'll close our meeting this evening, brethren and sisters, by singing together hymn 135, followed by a word of prayer. Hymn 135.